Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Bradley Gerard. How are you doing, Bradley?
Very good, thanks, John.
Good week?
It's been a good week, yeah. It's been still fairly busy on results. Not quite as chaotic as recent weeks, but...
Yeah, it didn't feel like that at 7 o'clock yesterday evening, but there you go. Ian Smith, how are you doing, Ian?
Not too bad, John. How are you doing?
All right. Well, I was off a bit last week.
So was I.
You weren't here either. So you were here.
I was here.
And so you would have done the podcast with...
With Mark.
Robbo, yes. Yeah. All right, was it?
Fine, yep. He was on good form.
Good. Well, I'm back. Feeling wonderful. Feeling refreshed. Feeling a little bit older.
And I'm back with a beard.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to shave mine off now.
It's the talk of the office.
I heard after Bradley joined the fraternity, I felt I was compelled to. It's some kind of IC dress code.
Yeah, Graham, where's yours?
I'm trying.
I know you can grow a beard, Graham. I saw it when you were off for a bit. We met up at the cricket one
That's
day.
That's true,
so.
Yeah.
It was a good beard, too.
Yeah, a couple of weeks.
Anyway. Let's stop talking about beers. Let's talk about the magazine, because that's what we're here for. So it's been a very busy week, not necessarily in results terms. I mean, still quite busy, quite a few results. Some of the AIM guys coming through, some retailers coming through as well at this time of the year, as we kind of said before. But lots of kind of really quite interesting features in this week's magazine. It's kind of caught us by surprise. So I went out for some beers a couple of weeks back with the guys at Share. Pad, Ionic Information. They're an information provider that I'm sure a number of our readers will use to do their sort of data crunching and portfolio management. And we kind of had this idea, let's kind of do some analysis in the magazines. So we've got a really long feature, which is written by their in-house analyst, Phil Oakley, looking at house builders and how you actually go about analysing them. And I think it's really quite interesting. Good number crunching, good educational stuff there, and we're going to carry that on for a few weeks. And what we'll be doing next week is Jonas will respond. So in fact, each sector writer, in this case Jonas, will respond to what Phil's written in the previous week. So it's going to work out quite nicely.
And it's a really big topic at the moment, isn't it? You know, looking
what
at house builders, looking at the valuations, you know, how are they responding to the referendum? Where's the price inflation with the builders?
Yeah, absolutely. And where are house prices going? And in fact, what Jonah said to me this morning was what he's going to do is look at some of the kind of more qualitative insights that you could perhaps put around the quantitative stuff that Phil's done here. So I think this is going to work out really nicely. Really pleased with that. And Bradley, you obviously wrote the cover feature, which again is quite educational. How do you look at the debt that companies have?
Yep.
And yeah, I mean, you know, it's there's a lot of moving parts there. Again, you know, it covers buybacks, pensions, and lots of stuff there. We'll talk about that in a minute. And in fact, Algie, he ran something recently called the Cash Clinic, really looking at not necessarily the earnings of companies, which can be manipulated, but the cash and the cash flows that sit behind a business and really underpin companies' ability to pay dividends. And what he did this week, having done Marks and Spencer's a few weeks ago, was screened for candidates to keep that series going. And again, you know, there'll be some insights there that you can use investors off the bat. But really, it's an educational initiative designed to help you understand how to look at a company's cash flows. Okay, so. Loads there.
Tons.
And we'll talk about your feature in a minute, as I said, but let's start with the news, because again, a really quite kind of busy week on the news front.
Yeah, it's been very busy. It's quite a retail kind of focused news section this week. There's so much going on. I mean, I guess one thing from 7 days I'll start off with is a potential issue with our sort of, you know, our divorce or our ongoing divorce from the EU. There's a big story in the FT as well this week. So we've got 5,500 UK registered financial services companies who use passports or agreements that are known as passports to just trade in the single market, you know, without any issue. But interestingly, there are actually more than 8,000 businesses in Europe who use the same agreements to trade with us. So I just thought that was kind of interesting potential balance of power in negotiating there, because it's going to be troublesome for the UK if we lose those passports, but it will be for the EU too. So it's just potentially an interesting indicator of how negotiations might go, that things, you know, there are pros and cons both ways basically to how Britain does, you know, remove itself from the European Union.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, some of the more hardline Europeans, Eurocrats, if you want to use that expression, would argue that, well, they can simply move the financial centres, the business that's being done in London, to places in Europe, whether it be Frankfurt or Warsaw, I've heard spoken about.
And we had Lloyds of London talking about that today, didn't we? Their CEO was talking about exploring whether they could set up, you know, an office somewhere within the European Union in order to, you know, mitigate that risk of the business continuity.
Absolutely. So, I mean, yeah, whether, obviously that's a cost to businesses, though, so it would be very, they'll probably not want to do that in an ideal world. They can and have that ability, as you say. But I guess it's just sort of an interesting thing that sort of struck me this week.
I think it is very interesting. One of the things that Nicole Elliott, who writes our trading coverage, said to me was, yes, but John, the thing that people forget about London is it's where people want to live. It's where the wives or husbands of the guys who are working in these industries want to live. And you know, I kind of get that. Yeah. See, Frankfurt's a very boring place. Yeah,
London definitely, as kind of one of the world's great cities. Obviously, we're biased. That cultural centre is a big part of it, right? But another big part of it is the financial centre. So that's what's really interesting to see what will happen here. And I'm conscious that Bradley and I both live in East London, under the shadow of Canary Wharf. And that's a big part of it too. But yeah, I think that's a really good point that you can't ignore, you know, the other draws of London apart from business.
One of the world's great cities. There you go. You sort of take it for granted when you come here every day, struggling on a train. And
doesn't feel like it at that point.
Don't get started on trains.
Let's not talk about trains.
Not one of the great tube networks.
No. Oh, the tube network's fine. Yeah, the tube network is good. It's the ones that come in that are not so great. Anyway. What else you got, Bradley?
Another thing which kind of piqued my interest as well is a couple of references to it, really, is share buybacks. So Microsoft, it raised its dividend by 8%, which sounds like quite a chunky amount. This was actually below what Morgan Stanley expected, though. They expected a rise of 10%.
So no pleasing some people.
Exactly.
Is there, really?
So what Microsoft has done to please those people is announce a buyback program up to $40 billion on top of its already existing $40 billion buyback program. And in the numbers section on 7 Days, Target, which is based in Minneapolis in the US, is a big retailer up there. They've launched a $5 billion share buyback. I think it's always useful to look at the US market and where it is and look at what could happen in the UK, because this is quite late stage stuff with these massive buybacks. It sort of suggests that the earnings multiples are going to look much better for these companies, but the thing that's driving them is, it's not that long term. You know, you can't go on buying your shares forever, and there's potentially a danger that this will lead to a lack of investment in these businesses, although they are very big and large businesses, and that potentially is an issue. And we are sort of starting to see a few more buybacks coming in the UK market, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with it, but it has to stop at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not necessarily that these businesses will be starved of investment. It's that there isn't anywhere to invest within these businesses. There is nowhere to better use that money to boost earnings.
Well, hopefully
by buying back shares.
Hopefully that is actually the case, but you do wonder whether someone as, you know, sort of entrepreneurial and iconic as Microsoft really cannot find better use for their money. Like, surely, I know they probably are still investing an awful lot of money.
Well, I don't know if you saw the story this morning, but on Microsoft, in fact, which have come out and said that Windows 10 is basically a diabolical experience for users, and having spent the last year fending off an enforced upgrade, and I got through it.
Did you?
Yeah. Never got upgraded.
That's stubbornness.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. Have they got anywhere best to invest in? I mean,
suggests yes, they do. They need to improve their
invest more in getting your operating system right. But yes, it's I have a Windows phone. Not a happy experience.
I had one. Past tense, don't now.
Yes, stop spending your money on buybacks, Microsoft, and make my phone better.
There you go.
But is it better for investors, just to give the other side of the argument, that they improve shareholder value rather than for these huge companies make some acquisition of a kind of new company that they think is going to protect them in some market? And we've seen huge write-downs of some of these acquisitions, haven't we, from some of the big players. And you wrote about Unilever actually this week, doing a couple of these much smaller acquisitions. But I kind of wonder whether, I think from the other side of the argument, you could say, I'd rather there be a share buyback program than a misguided acquisition of the kind of in vogue company at the moment.
Well, I kind of get that. And, you know, in the case of Unilever, I mean, the deal it did was very small.
Well,
it's kind
small,
of greenwashing up liquid.
Not a good example.
It's not going to move the dial. No, I mean, it is a good example because it suggests that the acquisitions that are there to be done are not big enough to actually make a difference, really.
Yeah.
That's very much the theme of the moment that a lot of people are talking about, is, you know, those big encumbered businesses who are trying to kind of protect themselves as their industries change. But yeah, these are very small acquisitions. Can they can be transformative.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could argue buy a small business that does something like greenwashing up liquid and then invest in it over a number of years actually move the whole market towards those kind of products. So, I mean, you know, there is a case to say, well, a small acquisition doesn't necessarily move the dial in the first instance, but over time it might if it's invested in properly.
I guess, I mean, in Unilever's case, it's a bit more tangible and easier. Like, it's very potentially not obvious, but it's a kind of major trend at the moment. People are becoming a bit more environmentally aware, so buying a sort of ethical company does make sense. With Microsoft, obviously, it's potentially a bit more difficult because fads change all the time, and something that's looking like it's going to just absolutely fly all of a sudden becomes unpopular,
especially in the media landscape,
trumped by something else.
Something like, look at what happened to Yahoo, you know, and
yeah,
kind
exactly.
of businesses that was it Tumblr that it bought. You know, a vast
Tumblr,
price.
What does that do?
It's a blogging platform that
people thought
would get, which actually did get quite popular, but then obviously other kind of blogging platforms and social media companies have massively gone past it. So they had to write down quite a lot of that acquisition, and ultimately, as we know, the CEO stepped down.
I guess this theme is quite relevant actually to one of our news stories this week, which is on Burberry. So for the first time, basically what Burberry has done is rather than showcase its next fashion line behind closed doors to only the great and the good, what it's done is stream live its latest catwalk show in London as part of the London Fashion Week. And as those clothes are, you know, making their way down the catwalk, anyone can go and buy them online. And Burberry's shares have, over London Fashion Week, performed extremely well. And actually, analysts think that this is going to be, yes, a short-term kicker now, but could, in the long term, be a great strategy. And it's an interesting, maybe a similar example of, you could argue, maybe there hasn't been a lot of investment in this, but it shows you know, management teams sort of really trying to make sure they're delivering something that's going to make the business last and have longevity and be around for longer and be relevant.
I think it's quite clever.
It's very clever.
The only thing I would see as a problem with it would be that you need to kind of wait for at least a year to get a sense of how the annual sales have performed, because I suppose one thing it could just be doing is changing the seasonal, you know, bringing forward that seasonal sales. So I'd be interested as to whether, as it promotes engagement with potential customers, it is actually creating more sales rather than just earlier sales.
True. No, it'd be interesting to see how that transpires, absolutely.
And you can read about it in the IC.
You can.
I think it's a good digital strategy, bringing old world and new world together. I think that's quite clever. But I guess Burberry have also benefited from a bit from kind of tourism spending. So
there is that prospect too, that people who watch the stock are considering that, you know, when Burberry's obviously a very important fashion brand for the UK, people will travel, you know, to the UK, or people travel to shop, and if they're in the UK, they'll likely go to Burberry. And if you are holidaying in the UK from abroad, things are much cheaper. So there is a bit of an assumption that there has been a bit of a sterling kind of kick to their results. But it would seem that the sort of the 10% rise over London Fashion Week is as much to do with the new strategy as sterling's weakness.
Yeah. And maybe
the new management structure as well, which shareholders wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. That hadn't really worked out, the previous experiments.
Yeah, the chief and being chief creative didn't work that well.
Beyond the pages of our magazine, Burberry has absolutely no meaning in my life whatsoever, so I'll take your word for it.
Well, I take Harriet's word for it, because like you, I'm not a Burberry disciple.
No. I mean, one retailer who I have bought stuff from who's not having such a great time is Majestic Wine. And this was a shocker of a profit.
They had a torrid time yesterday. Yeah, the shares were down, I think, even by the end of the day, down a quarter. The big issue there really seems to be in commercial sales, which are pretty important to the company. So yes, they have their own sort of retail estate where one can walk in and buy the wines from them, but the commercial sales to the things, guests like hotels, bars, that kind of thing, and maybe even small shops and stuff, corner shop chains or something, have not been performing well at all. And to compound those problems, they've entered into the US relatively recently. Their mail campaign there to trim up new business hasn't gone very well. And yeah, there are a few little problems that have culminated at the same time.
I've got to admit, I haven't looked at this business for quite some time. It used to be quite a straightforward operation. You know, it had shops. They were warehousey in nature, even though they're retailers. You used to buy your wine by the crate, and you know, the more shops it opened, the better it did. But since then, so the chief executive, if I remember rightly, changed.
So basically,
there was something a bit weird about that. If I remember at the time,
they bought Naked Wines, and what ended up happening was that the chief executive of Naked Wines became the chief executive of the enlarged entity.
Yes, Naked Wines is more like an online wine.
Yeah, their shtick, I suppose, is that they deal with independent winemakers and they get wines made for them exclusively, and then they sell those on to obviously the retail customer at competitive prices. That was their kind of a key part of what they were about, and it had done very well. Hence, the reason why Majestic wanted to buy it. But you suspect that the success of Naked Wines and the historic success of Majestic means it's probably salvageable, but there are a few things, as I said, culminating at the same time, which make it quite difficult. And I guess things like, I mean, Majestic has tried to, I remember recently or early this year, they removed that sort of whole six bottle minimum thing. They thought that would help
it out.
Well,
they've gone down from 12 to six previously.
Yeah. So they've done things to kind of encourage the retail customer, but it seems now maybe they have to try and do something to encourage commercials.
It looks like they got their entrance to the US wrong with Naked Wines, right? They spent a lot on this marketing campaign.
I mean, that sounds like a terribly difficult thing to do. Many British businesses have tried to crack the US and treat it with their tails between
apart from
legs.
The fat and lazy ones that don't try and export, according to Liam Fox on New International Trade.
Yeah, I'm not sure he was too well received on that point. Going into the US is very tough.
Yeah, and I think definitely there's a risk of overreacting to this kind of news as well. They've tried something, the marketing, they've spent a lot of the marketing. That's going to hurt their profits in the short term. But, you know, maybe they'll try something else. Or maybe they really misunderstood that market in terms of whether they really want that.
Easily done. I mean, the US is... It's not one market, is it? I mean, it's a huge place. There's lots of different regional markets there that, you know, I mean, you look at the US stock market, you know, we have a writer who occasionally contributes some ideas to our magazine, and he comes, oh, you know, he looks at US small caps, and some of I've never heard of them. They're huge companies.
Yeah.
Huge companies. You know, Nathan's Famous Restaurants. Ever heard of them? No. Massive. Probably bigger than any restaurant chain in the UK. But it's a massive, massive conglomeration of lots of different regional markets. Very difficult to understand. And this is my point about Majestic. From a simple business selling wine to UK customers, with a bit of a challenge from supermarkets and the ongoing supermarket price wars that had to be managed, it's now a little bit more difficult to understand.
Yeah, the way they retail alcohol in the US is just different from the UK. I suppose you can assume it's similar.
Yeah, and I guess the performance of Majestic, just lastly on it, is potentially interesting given that there's a bit in 7 days as well about how alcohol sales in UK supermarkets have surged 8.5% in the past 4 weeks.
So, well, you know, now we're leaving the European Union, we have to drown our sorrows.
Well,
somehow.
And we're cheering our Olympic glory
and cheering
as well,
and Olympic glory.
So, you know, the Brits are still drinking. Nothing's changed there. The supermarkets are managing to get the booze off the shelves.
Is it because they're selling it more cheaply? I mean, I guess the supermarkets have been doing better. So we had some results from Morrison this week. I mean, let's just jump ahead to that. I mean, they look all right.
Yeah, they're
And Tesco has some decent numbers, and the supermarket figures are looking okay. I mean, the discounters are still kind of winning a bit of market share, but everything looks a bit more level balanced than it has.
That's also because they're doing operational things that are improving, the cost cutting. But they haven't yet improved user experience, tried to improve their customer experience and those kind of things. But yeah, it doesn't seem quite as rough as it was.
No.
And also, I mean, Morrison's is still, I think, at the time we went to press anyway, according to SCA data, was still the second most shorted stock on the market. So, you know,
I'm
things
sure
will get. Things
not sure I always trust that data, but.
Well, maybe not, but. It's updated daily, apparently. But anyway, you know, the results from Morrison's, they were better, but there is still a bit of scepticism in the market.
Yeah, we'll see. But as long as they keep flogging me cheap booze, I don't care. John Lewis, we write about this week, was very unusual because it's not a listed company, but something noteworthy, presumably.
Yeah, there is rationale. Stuff. I haven't just gone completely mental. basically, John Lewis is very much used, or seen rather, as a bellwether of how, you know, the UK is performing, the UK high street is performing, how retail is doing. And Harriet's done a really good job here of just kind of looking at the challenges that John Lewis is wrestling with, and basically saying that being aware of those as an investor in listed retailers is really important, because what she's kind of really concluding, and she's doing a bit more on this as part of a wider sort of piece and I think podcast soon as well.
Mm, I've been involved in this.
There you go.
Being a former retail correspondent myself.
Exactly. So her
showed up how out of date my knowledge was. There you go.
Her point really is that it's, you know, that if any retailers are kind of suggesting Brexit as a or the EU referendum result has caused a problem for them, it's potentially a bit misguided. And actually, what is now key is how retailers manage their costs. That is the big key thing. You know, if they're sourcing pretty much products from especially the US or potentially Europe, and they're not selling an equal amount, then there's an issue there with the currency. Obviously there's the national living wage, which is creating wage inflation, and so it's quite a tough sector to deal in. And if you're selling more on the internet but you need to keep your store estate going, that's a cost. And these are long-term trends basically. We're just kind of saying, don't let Brexit be an allowable excuse, and really be aware of the sort of drivers behind retail performance.
I would never let that be an allowable excuse in the pages of the Investors Chronicle anyway. But we had some results from Next this week, and you know, Next, in fact, we had a couple of retailers reporting, Kingfisher as well, the DIY chain. But Next is interesting because Next is, you know, beyond John Lewis in a listed capacity, is probably the bellwether, along with Marks and Spencer, of the UK retail sector. And, you know, it's looking a bit tough there. And Next is not a company that makes mistakes.
No, exactly. And I think to Bradley's point, Next really bears out some of the things that he was talking about. I suppose what Next can do possibly more than John Lewis, although this is an arguable point, is raise its prices, which is one of the things they think about. But the other side of protecting their margins, they're looking to reduce their costs and reduce their production costs. But obviously you can only do that to such an extent. I was interested actually in the story. They talk about moving their production to new territories such as Bangladesh.
Yeah, I thought a lot of people use Bangladesh already. Primark.
Yeah, well, if we think back to that garment factory collapse in 2013, you know, there is a limit to which you can. And just to make clear, Next had no relation with that.
Primark
factory. But yes, there were a number of European retailers that had kind of their products being developed there. But there's a limit to how far you can push that in terms of reducing the cost of production. And there are risks to reducing the cost of production in that way. So,
well, you also had pressures from those local producing markets, so Bangladesh and Vietnam. And in fact, in Vietnam, around the same sort of time, there were massive protests about the working conditions and the wages that they were being paid there. So yes, there is an opportunity to cut costs by shifting production to a different market, but at the same time, they are inflationary markets themselves, so wages will rise there,
and that's why they're constantly moving to different markets.
Exactly.
The wonder of globalization.
Exactly.
Not brilliant for workers in said countries, but yeah. And I suppose that's why it's not surprising that they are also thinking about, or you know, one of the options is looking at the other side of things and increasing their prices. But on price deflation, that's something that John Lewis said was hurting them, and growing competition in terms of online. So, you know, it's not easy at either end when it comes to retail at the moment.
Yeah, Next share price looks pretty nasty. I mean, you know, this is a company that has a habit of under-promising and over-delivering. And
that's true.
And now it's under-promising and just about struggling to meet those promises.
Well, it has high costs. So we had French Connection's results as well in this week's issue. And if you look at the costs that they are running in terms of rent and growing staff costs, it's high. It's hard to, you know, say that is a business that is still going to be making good money in the kind of medium term.
So those costs are being borne outside of the UK or in the UK
in the
or
UK
everywhere?
For French Connection. But what Next has as a problem in particular that they've talked about is their buying costs have increased because they're buying stuff in dollars and then they're selling in pounds in the UK. So they don't get to kind of protect themselves when it comes to the currency translation. So, yeah, they have kind of multiple pressures. But as you say, Lord Wolfson has a knack of under-promising and over-delivering. So it could just be further cautionary comment.
They're going to get to a point where they're going to be very, very much worth buying, looking at that share price. And at 12 times earnings, you've got to think they're almost there.
Yeah.
But I'll certainly be keeping an eye on that. I think that is one great company. Definitely not one to write off.
But it will be a risk if they start increasing their prices.
Yeah, Kingfisher. I mean, that's a different story. I mean, this is a company that was under delivering for quite a long time, and that share price is flying, really.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. I mean, obviously the months aren't that on that share price chart, but it looks like since the referendum, it's just gone great guns. That's not just that maybe takes away from what management are doing. They did at the start of this year, I believe, or very back end of last year, launch their sort of 5-year transformation plan, which is going to, in their hopes anyway, yield a £500 million uplift to annual profits above what they make now once it's complete.
That's a lot of money. Their half-year profits, that's about the level of their half-year profits this time.
Exactly, yeah, it's a lot of money. But when you go through the plan, there are a lot of things that sort of quickly start to add up. So they're refining their kind of their main kind of core B&Q range, whereas before they might have stocked, say, I don't know, 7 types of sink or something, whereas now there'll only be 3. I mean, that's not a specific example, but just to give listeners the idea of what they're doing, they're just stocking fewer types of each kind of item, which reduces sourcing costs, distribution costs, lots of other things.
Doesn't it encourage people to go and say, well, they've only got 3 types of sink, I'm going to go and look around and see if I can find a nicer sink?
Well, think about as a big use for B&Q, think about paintbrushes, for example. You know, there will be multiple ranges of packs of paintbrushes. Now, the average person redecorating their house doesn't really need. Although there are differences between good and bad paintbrushes.
I've never been able to work out the difference between a £6 paintbrush and a £1 paintbrush.
I'll tell you, it's about the amount of bristles that come off when you're painting, which are rather annoying to pick off. Yeah, but anyway, let's not go down that route.
Yeah, that's a 50p paintbrush.
Yeah. But I think that does make the point. You know, it's like, okay, you can have a premium range or you can get a brand in there, but you know, having multiple brands from the value upwards.
Basically, what when they launched the plan, what they said they were, what they believed they had done anyway, was got to a point where they were just offering too many types of different things. I mean,
yeah,
I think at the time I think they used the example of light bulbs, and it was a crazy amount of light bulbs they were selling, when really a light bulb was just a very simple thing. You either want it to be energy efficient or you don't, or you want it to be a couple of brightnesses, but you don't need a choice of 7 40 watt bulbs, you know, for instance.
So speak for yourself, bro.
Well, yeah, sorry. I'm so monochromatic in my bulb choice. But it also reduces the amount of, because one thing you don't think about is they have to display a lot of their items as well. So the more types of item they have, they have to display those, and they're not for resale. So
I see what they have got. They've got more lighting than I've ever seen in my life in a B&Q store.
Yeah,
not anymore.
Well, I think in this way, I'd go so far as to say they're learning a bit from Screwfix, which has been doing really well. And Screwfix, if you go into one, it's the simplicity. You would click and collect it, or you turn up. It's mainly a kind of a warehouse just with a kind of retail front.
This is a subject that has come up on several occasions on this podcast because I won't go in B&Q anymore.
Oh, really? Yeah.
No, I've just got a Screwfix.
Well, no, exactly.
And I think go to Screwfix and pay half the price.
Yeah, and you don't have to stand in an interminable queue, you know, as I said in the company's email the other day, behind someone buying a massive pot plant or whatever happens in B&Q and have a panic attack in a long queue. But yeah, no, I think that Screwfix in some ways is demonstrating to them, you know, this is how it's changing. So it makes perfect sense. And they're also doing some changes to the click and collect, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, Screwfix is the absolute sort of darling of the whole company. It's performing extremely well. And
John Bellwether human.
it is doing very well, but yeah, there are other things as well. So they offer a click and collect service for B&Q, and of course that's how Screwfix does operate as well. There's improvements there which should help improve the operating margins within the UK division, and yeah, you know, the French business is kind of stabilizing. There's nothing, you know, amazingly great in the performance, but it's stable, and that's probably about all you can ask for in the French economy at the moment. But yeah, it's a big plan. They've got big aims for it. And the share price would maybe partly suggest that there's growing belief in it working.
Yeah, it's interesting. French chief exec as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I remember
Veronique Lowry, I think she's called.
Yeah, that's right.
I think
it is. No, I remember my childhood holidays to France. I always remember massive supermarkets and loads of DIY shops.
Multicolour pens.
Monsieur Bricolage. Brico Depot.
That's them.
Is that them?
No, Costarama's them.
Costarama, right.
I think of those like pens that have the eraser on the other end.
Yeah, yeah, those. That was a highlight of my summer holidays.
That literally was the highlight.
Going to the Mammoth and buying like all my stationery for the year ahead.
That is sad, isn't it?
What a wonderful trip down memory lane.
Anyway, right, so let's talk about your feature. So it's about debt.
It is.
And I must admit, you said, I've got this idea about good debt, bad debt. You know, when should companies carry lots of debt? What companies can get away with carrying lots of debt? When does debt become a problem? And that sounds good, Bradley. And then the next thing I know about it was when I saw it.
Yeah, it was.
And I think you did a good job.
There was a bit of a germination period, that's for sure. But yeah, hopefully, you know, we'll obviously give listeners a brief overview of it now, and hopefully the readers will find it useful. So I've kind of broadly looked at some of the key metrics that fund managers really like to use to analyse debt. And I guess that.
And you have spoken to quite a few fund managers.
I have, yeah. And I guess the context of doing this now is the fact that obviously we've just had the Bank of England enter the fray in terms of buying corporate bonds. Interest rates are at record lows. It's potentially a very good time for companies to borrow more, which in a way makes it almost, you know, puts a greater imperative on investors to make sure they know why the companies they invest in are borrowing, what it's being used for, whether it's actually reducing the cost of debt, perhaps, or they're just refinancing. So in a way, it's becoming really important now to understand a debt profile, given the sort of macro environment we're in at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, it's quite complicated. So, you know, we have a figure in our results tables, gearing.
Yeah.
And gearing is essentially the ratio of debt to net assets. Generally speaking, 100% gearing would be basically the level of debt is the same as the level of assets in the company. And a lot of the time we'd look at a company with 100% gearing and say, that's better be watchful of this. But then often we see companies with much greater gearing than that, but it's fine. And it seems to be the case for a long, long time.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you kind of look at just a basic kind of net debt to sort of cash profits ratio, which is favoured quite a lot by fund managers, it's not worth looking at it in isolation because, as you say, it could be a property company thereby has assets that it can easily sell, or assets, especially at the moment, if they're in London and other regions that are appreciating quite well in value. So it depends on sort of what assets they have that could be the sort of securitization for that debt. That's quite important. And also the type of business that they are. I mean, a lot of fund managers would argue that something like a utility company can have a lot of debt because it's
well, they don't know exactly how much they're
exactly
going to be receiving from
yeah,
their customers.
They've
for
got
a long,
near,
long time.
Not certainty of income, but they've got a pretty good idea. And also, not on that side of things, but sort of maybe some more, slightly more defensive retailers or consumer goods companies who rely on those regular, small, repeatable purchases where their business model is just selling things that we need, that we're not going to stop buying, like toothpaste or what have you, deodorant, those kinds of things.
Well, you mentioned Unilever in the feature. I don't know what their level of debt is, actually. Gearing perspective, but
yeah, no, I don't off the top of my head.
I do remember it's never been low.
No,
I mean, it's a big, they have a big chunky old debt pile.
Yeah, they do, and some would argue that's okay because of who they are and what they do. They're selling items that we regularly buy. We don't think about it. We're not going to stop buying them unless, you know, things get really, really bad.
Yeah, and a lot of their assets are intangible as well because they're brand assets.
Yeah.
So it's not like plant and machinery
no.
in a lot of cases.
So in a way, that's potentially an issue because obviously if things turn against them, then they haven't got that. Whereas
it's unlikely that things are going to turn against them.
It is very unlikely, but I guess what some people would say is it's quite nice potentially if a company is in difficulty that it has things it can sell and help repair the balance sheet a bit. Obviously, if it needs to sell it, then it's maybe not going to get a good price.
Yeah, I think we should be long out of that stock.
Yeah, yeah. Just the flexibility to be able to sell things can be good anyway in the right situation.
Yeah. So you have done some number crunching.
Yep.
Did you find anyone that we should be taking any paying any closer attention to?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually AA is a really good example of a company that kind of doesn't really score very well on the metrics. It's got quite a high level of net debt to cash profit. It's not the highest out of the data that we got from S&P Capital IQ, but pretty high. But potentially the most worrying thing is that its total debt to total assets as a ratio was 1.6, which is the highest of any of the companies that we had in the data set of companies above £100 million.
So that's going to be like 160% gearing if we are in basically the context of our results tables.
Yeah, so it's got a sizable debt pile for the size of the company.
And that's common, isn't it, in some ways for companies that come from have a private equity element of their history,
yeah,
right? It's that companies, like, they're loaded with debt and they put the back onto the market. So it's not always, you know, don't invest in this company. It's kind of how are they doing? And Saga was another one that we reported on the results this week. How are they doing at reducing that net debt to cash profits ratio? And if they're doing it in a measured way, it doesn't mean you shouldn't invest in them, but
no,
it is still a risk. And that's why we put the leverage ratio there. It's a little bit crude, but it's a good way. And when we have one for banks too, which is slightly different. But we put it there just as a kind of rule of thumb.
Yeah, exactly. It's just something to be mindful of. And as you say, actually, AA has been able to refinance some of its debt recently at a lower cost to it. So that is good, but it still does boast a very large debt pile off the size of the company. It's just something that you need to be aware of, because on a sort of net debt to cash profits level, as I say, it's not sort of the highest. It would probably be considered high, because it's within the top 20 of all the companies that we got through the screen. But yeah,
and it's there with companies that have, you know, a lot of debt as part of their, you know, business model.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I look down this list, and you've got property companies. Yeah. You would expect that they borrow to buy.
Yeah.
As you would when you were buying a house for your residential use. You've got the pub companies there that we know are probably still getting out of overexpansion.
Yeah.
Over quite a long period. It's taking them a very long time to get off of this list.
Yeah.
But again, essentially, they're the same as a property company.
They kind of are, yeah. I mean, they will often, well, there'll be a mixture of lease and ownership of buildings, yes, as you say. And some are even, I think his enterprise has a growing kind of commercial property arm as well. So
yeah, the ones that I kind of, that jump out to me is a Shire.
Mm.
I mean, that's a farmer group.
Yeah.
But then their debt may be high because they've just bought a very large company.
Yeah, that might have. They actually this week issued were going to issue a very large bond as well. So that probably does.
A bond to presumably refinance their.
To help their, fund their, the acquisition of Baxalta, yeah.
Yeah. It's a bridging loan that they had.
It's a bridging loan. Yeah, you never want one of them for too long.
Exactly. If you bought a house with one of those, you'll know why John said that.
In fact, Shire, it's been a tip of ours. It's done extremely well.
Yeah, it's done.
Since tip update really well. This week.
Transformational acquisition.
So there is an example of debt being managed properly. And actually, you know, one thing that you mentioned here, this I've never seen before, is what you talk about with Serco.
Yeah.
So there's a company that, you know, it's had its fair share of troubles lately. And, you know, you look back at that company, and so you have three very excellent graphs here, which show how it's managing, not just bringing down its overall indebtedness, but how it's actually managing the peaks and troughs of indebtedness that occurs within the year. So we see debt, and what you see in the magazine is at a period end, but that doesn't reflect changes in debt throughout the period.
Exactly, yeah.
And what this shows is that those changes can be quite large.
Yeah, I mean, basically, debt can be sort of flattered by ensuring that as a business, you collect as much as is owed to you from your customers, you run down your inventory, and you delay paying creditors ahead of key reporting dates.
So
you
kind of like,
perhaps. So you kind of like, the phrase is kind of like dive for the line, I suppose. So you report this this net debt level on this day, because that's the day of your half or year end.
The next day you pay all your suppliers.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So then it changes, and that's fine. And to a degree, that's just, you know, that will happen naturally in any company, but it can be done to a level where it's more aggressive.
And therefore, when it's done aggressively, you're not really being given a true picture.
You're reading a net debt figure that probably is higher throughout the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that is potentially a fine level, but without further disclosure, it's a bit of a warning sign. So that's kind of those charts. If you have got the magazine in front of you, they will sort of show you how Serco has very much worked on its sort of intra-year cash management to make sure the net debt figure does not fluctuate so aggressively within the year, and it gives investors a much better idea of actually how indebted the company is.
That's really good to know. I've never seen it before done this way.
No, it was a great chart, and actually I have to say sort of thank you to all the fund managers I spoke to, but especially Harry Jack, who's an analyst over at Schroders, who flagged that example to me.
Yeah, I'd love to see this for more companies, actually.
Yeah, this was in Serco's annual report.
It was.
Yeah.
No, good for the. Well, it looks good now. I bet they weren't publishing this 3 years ago.
Perhaps not. But it does show, you know, that they are making steps to improve this, and it is sort of, there's tangible evidence of it actually happening there, which is good.
And some companies give the average debt over a period when they report, which
average
can
day,
be
yeah.
can
yeah.
be really useful for the same reason.
We don't really talk about that so much, though. Maybe we should.
I mean, it's not always disclosed. I mean,
get it for the standardised across all companies.
No. I mean, in that same box out, I mentioned Mears as well, and they kind of they do disclose that average net debt over, well, in their most recent results was a half year period. They disclose their average net debt figure on top of the net debt figure, because they're just vastly different because of working capital, the way the business works. So these things will happen, but if there's extra disclosure with it, it's not a problem. If you're telling people, then it's fine. But some companies maybe aren't as clear and lucid as they could be, or maybe historically were not. So yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. And the other things you talk about in this feature, which we don't necessarily need to go into detail now on, are the relationship between debt and pension deficits.
Yeah, of course, because often net debt doesn't look at things like pension deficits, doesn't encompass it.
It's a liability.
Yeah.
That's not included in the net debt figure. Exactly. Some of the retail lease obligations are not included. They will be in the future, but they're not now.
Yeah. So again, things like that are also very important. Just to be aware of, obviously we've had Carclay recently, which is a small company, and a company of its size ordinarily saying it's reducing its dividend wouldn't, you know, cause too many ruffles. But the reason behind its dividend cut, I think, it's still among an R-ing, but there's a potential it won't pay it in October, is because of its high pension deficit. So that is
so it's basically got to divert the money from...
Yeah.
Can't borrow anymore, needs to divert the money from... Exactly. Shareholder returns.
Pension deficits are a cash drag, so it's important that any company you're investing in, you understand the profile of that.
So there you go. So we have this incredibly educational issue, as it kind of turned out, sort of planned, but also sort of by accident. So we have Algie's Cash Clinic. That obviously relates to this feature on debt, which obviously relates very much to the work we're doing with SharePad and Philocally. So yeah, no, fantastic. Thank you very much, Bradley. So I guess we're almost out of time. We have covered a lot of ground here, including some of the results. Ian, were there any that you noticed particularly this week in the hopefully the final flurry of results season?
Well, actually, I think the next magazine might just be as long.
Don't say that.
we keep calling the end of the results season, and now, there's some smaller companies that we've tipped that I think kind of keep the party going in terms of results.
Great. They're great.
I just quick shout out for Megan's piece on GSK.
Oh, yes.
Other big
course,
company news.
Yeah, that was a big story.
Yeah.
In fact, GSK is the subject of the next Cash Clinic.
Oh, great.
Big dividend payer. Interesting financial situation there.
Yeah,
we have written on it
highly
before.
Highly complex.
Highly complex. Mr. Bearble has written on this before. And I think, he's concluded there's a lot of financial engineering going on here. We're going to try and get behind that.
Yeah, it's very difficult to look, especially if you look at the statement of equity changes. It's very interesting.
I haven't had that pleasure recently. So Megan's story, it's about the change of management there, which is very interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We know all that I suppose what we don't know about Emma Walmsley is exactly her plans for the business. But what we do know is some of her background. It's interesting that she's been... running the consumer healthcare range, which some kind of fund managers have wanted GSK to move away from. But this obviously looks very much like that's now going to stay as a core part of the group. So it's interesting strategically, and Megan does a really good job of setting in context the appointment. And also given the scandals that GSK has had in recent years, it's interesting having someone with a strong marketing background. Perhaps it's someone that was seen as being a good communicator that will be able to operate well when it comes to kind of corporate communications and marketing and getting the message out there and presenting GSK in the best light.
I think it's quite interesting. The consumer products business there, the kind of off-the-shelf drugs, and they still have Leukocyte?
Sure.
I don't know.
Out Sensodyne, Horlicks.
Sensodyne, Panadol, Horlicks, stuff that you can buy off the shelf, stuff that has kind of medicinal properties but isn't high-end pharmaceutical stuff. I mean, it's a big part of their business and presumably very profitable as well.
Yeah, and it's a quarter of all sales now. I think it's been growing as a proportion.
Look at someone like Reckitt Benckiser. They do similar off-the-shelf treatments. They've sold off the medicine side of its business, which became Indivior, the opiate treatments.
And some people see that as very short-termist. They're moving away from the higher risk, more investment-intensive areas that will bode them well over the next few decades towards things that they know in the shorter term will sell and provide good profitability.
Yeah,
what they should do?
No one's going to stop buying Sensodyne or Panadol or Horlicks or... But you might invest a huge amount of money in a cancer drug that doesn't work. I do wonder whether this is GSK saying we want to go down a consumer products route, a safer route. We don't care about generics. We don't necessarily think that investing in big drugs is where our future is.
Exactly right.
Unless the new government incentivizes it, I suppose.
Yeah.
There's talk of.
It is fascinating. Whereas I think Astra's gone, very much it's bet the farm on we're going to develop some big treatments.
Yeah, it's got a big pipeline compared to GSK.
And also, as Megan points out, with this growing political debate around the price of drugs, in the US with...
$10,000 tube of spot cream, is it?
Yeah.
Exactly right. It might... A more diversified business model that includes more consumer staples and less completely sensitive products might be sensible.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. Okay. I think we are running out of time, and yet there's so much more to discuss in the magazine. So we have a sector focus from Emma Powell on subprime lenders, who still seem to be doing quite well.
Yeah, they kind of come back. Low interest rate environment is obviously helping them. There's a lot of consolidation going on in that sector. We've had non-standard finance joining the fray.
And another one, Morse.
Yeah, Morse's club.
Never heard of them, but
yeah. So yeah,
learn something new every week.
Yeah, you could say, look, have we had a lengthened credit cycle as a result of lower for longer interest rates? Is it now the worst time to get into these companies because you think it's all about to go wrong? Potentially, but at the same time, monetary policy, it has been soft and the consumer demand for credit continues to be high. So, for the short term at least, they look to be set fair.
Indeed. And in fact, I saw the IHS Market Household Finance Index this week, which suggested that after the Brexit wobble, pretty much everybody is kind of fairly sanguine about their financial health and prospects for the future. Lots in the personal finance and funds section, including an excellent big theme by Kate Bealey on biotech, which is interesting in the context of what we just said about GSK. And I think she's recorded a podcast on that subject as well. And it's actually what we're going to be looking at again in next week's cover feature. It's a massive, massive area. All the usual tips, comment, more results than we've had time to mention today, and actually more news as well than we've had time to mention today. So anyway, thank you very much, Bradley. And thank you, Ian. It's good to be back. Pick up the magazine, Debt Health Check, £4.70, all good news agents, or get on the website and subscribe. And we'll be back again next week. Thank you very much.